Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And we are joined once again by our colleague, Brian Heater. Thanks again, Brian.
It's been too long, Anthony. Glad to be back.
That's how it always feels. Well, I believe the last time you were on the show, so I should say the main thing we're going to be doing on this episode is reviewing the two different Fyre Festival documentaries on Netflix and Hulu. But before that, I figured we should talk a little bit about the Oscar nominations. And Brian, I think the last time you were on, we were reviewing Roma, which has done very well. I think it's one of the most nominated movies along with The Favorite, and is nominated for Best Picture. So it's like basically Netflix's first real chance at winning Best Picture.
Yeah. Is this the first sort of non-traditional movie studio movie to be nominated for Best Picture?
Yes, I at least certainly in our lifetimes. I mean, there may be something from like 1935 or something
before movie studios.
But essentially, I mean, certainly since the advent of streaming, this is the first time a streaming film has been nominated. It's also, I mean, relatively rare for a foreign language film to be nominated for Best Picture, so that's pretty unusual too.
I think it's going to be a nice opportunity for people to actually go and see it in theaters, as I don't believe any of us actually did. That's kind of part of this like non-traditional release, is most people saw it through Netflix, which is, unless you have like an 88-inch screen, is probably not the ideal way to watch Roma.
I think that's true. Although a lot of the movie theater chains, so I guess a lot of them do these sort of like mini, you know, festivals of here, you know, on these days you can see all the different Best Picture nominees, but all the chains basically are still refusing to show Roma. So they will show all the other Best Picture nominees.
Is that right? Why are they refusing to show it?
Because they said it's our policy that we don't show, you know, it's the same reason why they didn't show Roma during its initial theatrical run, which is that they basically require there to be at least a 3-month window of exclusivity for the theatrical release, and anything that doesn't meet that requirement, they're not going to show it. So, I mean, there'll still be plenty of theaters where you can see it. It's just, I think the big chains, you're not, people who live in big cities with, you know, a decent amount of movie theaters, there's still going to be opportunities. But the chains are not going to be showing it. And I think realistically, most people are still going to watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, I watched it on my TV on Netflix. I wouldn't say that was a bad way to do it.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. Obviously that's just one of a number of different nominees. Black Panther, which I was really happy to see, was nominated for Best Picture. Was there anything in terms of the nominations that you guys were particularly excited or annoyed by?
Well, I saw Vice.
Did you like
and
Vice?
I really liked
oh,
Vice.
God.
Yeah, I liked Vice. How do you not like Vice?
Have you seen The Big Short? It was just
it was all
the same goofy tricks. It was just very like
smirking
at the camera.
Like it was good.
I don't know. I didn't love it.
Oh, I enjoyed that about it, because I feel like if you don't do that with this movie at this time in history, then you're kind of getting yourself into a shithole. Like, I feel like by doing that and turning, like, using all of those tricks, right? Like, at one point they're ordering from a menu, and on the menu is like, just what was it? It was like torture and. Anyway, I'm not doing a great job at explaining myself, but I thought that they did. I thought that made it far more fast-paced and interesting and fun than it.
It's sort of like energy and like creativity.
Yeah,
of the
exactly.
There was a point where they were sitting in bed and just started reciting it, like a Shakespearean soliloquy. It was, I don't know, it was a little too cutesy. But I will say
that part was a little bit. And also, I went to the bathroom and came back in the middle of that, so like I was really confused. I was like, I don't know how we got here. My mom was like shaking her head.
I do think Sam Rockwell does deserve the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, because he was amazing as W.
Well, and my whole thing is that Amy Adams should get whatever she's nominated for from here on out, pretty much. So, and we all know how I feel about
that. It seems like some people think that, like, you know, regardless of whether or not she deserves it for this movie, it's kind of just stupid that she
like
doesn't have an Oscar yet.
Overdue. So. Yeah. It's like Leo's Oscar. It's like, come on, just give it to her. I don't even care what it's for.
Yeah.
Although I think she did a great job in Vice. That's not to say she didn't do a great job. She's always fantastic, but.
Right. And that was the same thing with Leo in The Revenant too, is I think he like did really well in The Revenant, but there was also a sense of, you know, the first time, you know, regardless of what you think of how he did in The Revenant, as long as he didn't like totally half-ass it, you should just give him an Oscar by now.
Right, exactly. It's overdue. So I'm rooting for Amy in that category, even though she's joined by fantastic nominees for supporting actress.
Did anyone here actually see, like, if we can for a second, like, divorce it from all the horrible Bryan Singer garbage, but did anyone actually see Bohemian Rhapsody? That seems like an odd choice for Best Picture, even.
Although it won the Golden Globe. So because Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody were the two main.
Well, so was it technically a musical?
I think so. I mean, that's the weird thing about the way they, comedy. No, sorry. Bohemian Rhapsody won for drama. Green Book won for comedy or musical, which I don't understand how that makes any sense at all. But I would, you know, I've seen Green Book. It was a lot better than I was expecting. But I hope it doesn't win. And Bohemian Rhapsody, I have not seen. Maybe I will see it if they put it on HBO Go or Netflix. But I also hope that does not win.
Is Roma the favorite?
I think Roma or A Star Is Born, I think, are considered the favorites at this point.
The favorite is not the favorite.
No, I mean, it's a weird movie. I mean, I really like it, but I sort of have a hard time imagining that the Academy would go for that.
I will say that, like, I'm very pleased that Olivia Colman was nominated, because has anyone watched Peep Show?
I've seen a few of the skits.
Which is, no, Peep Show is a series. Oh. Mitchell and Webb.
Was
the sketch comedy show. Peep Show is like one of the best comedy television shows of the past 10 years. And she was amazing in that. And it's awesome to see her getting like dramatic acting recognition. She's a very good comedic actress as well.
Well, and then she's about to be on The Crown. So I think that's probably going to increase her visibility really dramatically too.
Anyway, my point is, watch Peep Show. Watch that 5-year-old show. That's my recommendation for this episode.
But yeah, I think there are a number of reasons why I think Roma might not win. I think the big one is the language thing. I just don't think a foreign language film has ever won for Best Picture, which is kind of crazy. I think the closest was The Artist, which was a French film, but it was silent, so it didn't have the, you know, it wasn't quite the same thing. But I think a lot of people still think it's a front runner, and certainly if it doesn't win for Best Picture, that Alfonso Cuarón will win for Best Director, which is both well-deserved, but also is kind of amazing that I think that it means that for the last 5 years, either Cuarón or Del Toro or Alejandro Iñárritu, who are like three friends from Mexico, they call each other the Three Amigos, have won Best Director for every year, except for 1 year out of the last five. So like they basically own the Oscars at this point.
They're all very good directors. I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah, no complaints. No complaints. Anything else jump out at you guys from the Oscars?
I mean, Black Panther is interesting. I mean, do you think this sets a precedent? I mean, they were talking about this in the lead up, right? Wasn't there some talk around having a category specifically devoted to blockbusters
for popular movies? And
yeah,
that seems. I mean, I think a lot of people thought it was a stupid idea because it was sort of like, if it's a popular movie that's very good, it should just be nominated for Best Picture, not for some separate, you know, junior category, which I think is fair.
This does seem to be sort of a bit of a compromise there, though, because, like, I can't remember the last time a movie in, I mean, this has got to be the first time a superhero movie.
It's the first time a superhero movie has been nominated. And I mean, part of that was a lot of people think that the reason why there are now more than five Best Picture nominees is because of the outcry when The Dark Knight was not nominated for Best Picture, and that they thought one of the ways you could just sort of get potentially more big budget, and it wasn't, I mean, superheroes are like, you know, one aspect of it. The other is just popular movies in general, and certainly there have been very, very popular movies that have won Best Picture in the past, but I think there's a sense in the last few years that more and more of the Best Picture nominees are these, you know, smaller films that don't necessarily, that people aren't necessarily excited to see win and aren't necessarily tuning in to see win. So they wanted to just get more popular films into the competition. I think Black Panther totally deserves it. I mean, there are certainly other superhero movies that I would have liked to see nominated, but I think that Black Panther, I mean, of the movies nominated, I think Black Panther is the best film, and I would give it to it over Roma. Although I think there's a bunch of reasons why that's not going to happen, but I love Roma, but Black Panther, I think on its own merits, Black Panther deserves to be nominated for Best Picture.
Well, this is a confluence of two different things. So, you know, the first one is that I think, you know, in a lot of cases, certainly this isn't the case across the board, but blockbuster movies have just generally gotten better. Marvel Studios played a big role in that, and that they're hiring, like, you know, really good directors to actually do them. And then the other one, to be like a little more crass about it, is I think the ratings are down for the Oscars. Yeah. So they're finding a way to bring more people in by having some of these more prominent movies, you know, be up for Best Picture. That's clearly what the play was when they were going to have a specifically Best Popular Movie category.
Right. And I mean, the one other aspect of that is the Academy over the last, after sort of the Oscars so white controversy, the Academy, I think, really tried to bring on a lot more younger members. So the Academy being the people who vote for the Oscars, to bring on younger members, more members of color. And I think that, you know, I suspect that Black Panther is a movie that plays a lot better with that audience than, say, the older, whiter sort of core Academy membership. All right, so let's move into our main review, which is of two different documentaries, Fire, which is on Netflix, and Fire Fraud, which is on Hulu. I believe both of you watched both of the documentaries before we even knew we were going to do this review.
Right? I watched both the documentaries the day, like the evening that we recorded the last podcast. And I think like on the podcast, okay, we were like, we're going to do Fire. And Sarah was talking about Fire. And I was like, I'm just going to go ahead and watch these. And I watched them both in the same night. I just banged it out. You know what I mean?
I'm going to be honest. I watched both documentaries and then I watched the R. Kelly series and have since moved on to the Ted Bundy show on Netflix.
I watched all of Ted Bundy last night. I still have to watch R. Kelly, but you and I are really clearly on the same wavelength. Are we sharing a Netflix or something?
I worry about both of us and all of our loved ones.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I feel far less influenced by the last few things I've watched than Marie Kondo. I'll just put it that way, if that helps anyone feel safer.
Don't get Brian started on Marie Kondo.
Okay, let's forget about that.
I do wonder what Marie Kondo's tips for disposing of bodies would be. It's probably very efficient.
Gotta burn them. Something like that.
Yeah. But you thank them before you throw them out.
Oh my God.
Only surround yourself with corpses that bring you joy.
Yeah, this one sparks joy. Oh my God, we're creeps. Let's stop.
So as given that we were all interested in this subject and that we're all New York City media people, I assume how much of what was in the documentaries surprised you, and how much of it was, oh, I like knew the whole story of Fyre Festival before?
Okay, I'll go. I think the things that were most illuminating for me were a deeper look into the McFarlane guy, obviously, because he's just like a legit con man, right? So it's always interesting to learn the stories of con men. And then the other parts that I thought were interesting was the team at Fyre, like the original, like the Fyre app people. Like that to me was pretty heartbreaking. And like when it was all going down, I assumed that a lot of people in the Bahamas were screwed over by the situation, but like seeing it and witnessing it, not firsthand because it wasn't behind the camera, but you get what I'm saying, like hearing it from their perspective was also one of the things that really kind of got to me, because I think, and the both of the documentaries do a good job of showing this, that it was like kind of this funny thing when it happened, but it really was like a huge deal. It really violated a lot of people's trust, a lot of people, you know, you just don't really realize the reach. And it wasn't all spoiled rich influencer kids, you know, it was other people too. So,
yeah, just seeing people talk about, you know, I guess how they, you know, that there were so many people who put work into this, and it sounds, and in some cases put money into it, and that basically it sounds like most of that money went up in smoke. And I mean, I think in some cases, in like, for example, when you're talking to the fire employees or other people who maybe were involved in organizing the event, I think there's a slightly self-serving aspect to them telling that story because they also don't want to be painted as the villain. And so
you're talking about the Netflix one?
Yeah. I mean, in both cases, but mostly a lot of the people on the Netflix one, that both like the people who work for Fire, the app company, the people who work for, you know, Jerry Media, there's, and I'm not saying that they're like being cynical or lying, but I think that, you know, if you're going to be on camera for a documentary like this, talking about your involvement in this really fucked up thing, it you're naturally going to want to tell the story in a way where you're the villain who, I mean, not the villain, where you're the victim who got screwed over versus, you know, somebody who was complicit.
Right.
You know, more involved.
I think
of the two of them, I think Netflix did a better job of kind of giving a background on a lot of the locals. And the fact of the matter is, the way this was going to play out regardless was that I watched both of these hoping for like a certain amount of like voyeuristic schadenfreude, but and got it, you know, and it was kind of nice to see all these people, all these influencers who seem awful, have to, you know, slog through this island for 2 days and, you know, like live out of these camps. And things did look kind of like one of the worst camping trips I've ever been on. But the fact of the matter is that every single one of those people, every single one of these like Instagram celebrities, every person who had the money to spend to go to a festival like this, it's going to be fine. They were going to have two kind of, you know, or a couple of crappy days on an island. It was, the planes maybe weren't what they were expecting. It was going to take them a while to get home. But once they got home, everything was going to be fine. But the people on the island who, you know, actually worked through this and who weren't paid, they were ultimately the ones who are going to suffer for all of this.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting is that, like, I feel like I got a lot more out of watching both than I would have gotten from watching a single one, which, I mean, obviously there's two movies, but like almost like, so back in the day, I thought that Dunkirk and what was it called? The Last Hour?
The Darkest Hour? The Churchill one?
The Darkest Hour. Yeah. The yes, Darkest Hour, right. And yeah. Dunkirk should be watched together, like as a double feature, and hopefully with Darkest Hour first. So you get the whole point of Dunkirk, right? Exactly. Yeah. And I felt like these movies were kind of like that. Like they were kind of two halves to a whole, in my opinion, as opposed to like pitting one against the other. Like I just felt like they were better.
Although
together.
They did go out of their way, that the fire fraud people did go out of their way to take a parting shot. I think they thought it was like a really clever thing at the end of the movie to point out the fact that the other one was produced by Jerry Media. That was like the punchline of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right. They definitely like painted it as like, yeah, the other one is the Jerry Media documentary. I think you're right that ultimately if this is a subject that interests you, you should watch both of them. That said, I mean, I understand it. And I think probably for me, if I wasn't discussing both in this podcast, I probably would have just watched one. And if you're just going to watch one, yeah, I would say watch the Netflix one. I do think that one's better. That one's like a better movie. And whereas the Hulu's one, I think, has a lot of interesting stuff in it, but is just not, I think, as put together, as a documentary.
Yeah, I think like the more beautiful one, the like easier on the eyes one is Netflix.
Yeah,
I mean,
he, you know, the
one, it just sort of tells a story in a more interesting way.
Yeah,
he's a very,
I agree,
seasoned. He actually directed one of my all-time favorite documentaries, which is American Movie. If you haven't seen it, you absolutely should. He's clearly just the better filmmaker, and he's the better editor, and just knows what to put in and take out. Hulu, the fire fraud one, they very much went, I think what they were going for was playing on all of this Instagram meme stuff and trying to make the movie, make these little meme vignettes. There were a lot of, you know, like Family Guy clips and clips from The Office. When they were reading text from a letter, it was all done on a robot voice. It was, I don't know. There were a lot of kind of cutesy tricks throughout.
Some of those worked better than others. I mean, in general, I wasn't crazy about it. And I thought they just sometimes didn't trust the footage, that the interview footage that they had, to be interesting. And so you just like see somebody's face talking for like 2 seconds, and then it would immediately cut to some sort of archival footage to illustrate it. But for me, the one that I really didn't like was the robot voice they used to basically recite transcripts, whether email or court transcripts or what have you. And I thought that really was
that was way off
misstep.
For sure. I was like, what am I hearing right now? Like, why is Siri chatting?
There were too many tricks where it made you very self-conscious of what they were doing, which, you know, a good documentary shouldn't. You should just be along for the ride. And every single time one of those came up, like you were kind of taken out of the movie and you know, paying attention to the fact that they had pulled some random clip in there.
Right. Well, so one of the things the Hulu documentary did have, though, is they had an actual, you know, their own interview with Billy McFarland, who was the person who organized Fire Festival and the Fire app. What did you guys think of that?
Did you do organize in scare quotes while you said that? Organize is a very strong word.
I guess, yeah, like theoretically or aspirationally organized. Supposedly organized.
So the producers of that paid him to be in the film. And there's a lot of back and forth, as you said earlier, that, you know, there's been some sparring between the two teams. The director of the Netflix one said he was told by Billy that the Hulu folks paid him $250,000 to be on the film, and he used that as leverage to try to get him to pay $150,000 for him to be in the film. The Hulu people took issue with that number and said basically, like, this guy is a con man. Of course he's going to make up a number, but they didn't deny the fact that they paid him money and probably, you know, a great deal of money. Now, like, ultimately, I doubt that that's going to make a dent in the tremendous amount of money that he currently owes everyone on all those lawsuits. But, you know, he's a lifelong scammer. And this did, I think because of that, they felt obligated to do a much deeper dive into his background. Much of the setup of the Hulu one versus the Netflix one was really just sort of like going into his background, going into the credit card company, talking about how everyone thought he was a genius because he took a piece of metal and turned it into a credit card. And I think because of all that background, they ultimately tried to paint him as a bit more of a sympathetic character.
I think that's how it started. But like by the end, it seemed like certainly the interview that they had seemed to get a lot more confrontational, where there was, you know, they would ask him about anything sort of related to the criminal cases against him, which, I mean, I think you sort of have to know that he's not really going to comment on, but it sort of took on this tone of just like them asking him questions. And like at one point saying like, has anyone ever called you a pathological liar? And then he just gets very defensive and says like, you know, name something I've said during this interview that's not true. And then they do this montage where they say a lot of things that he said in the interview that turned out to be untrue. So I think it feels like that maybe he thought he was going to come off more sympathetically, and they wanted to add some nuance. Also, his girlfriend is in the movie and sort of talking about her relationship with
him. That's weird.
But it really turned. It felt like it was still ended up being a pretty negative portrait. And like, one of the things I actually got kind of tired of is they just had lots of shots of him kind of sitting there silently, you know, kind of looking kind of pensive and awkward. In this way that I didn't find particularly interesting to watch. And also I feel like I'm always a little suspicious of, because that's footage that you can easily sort of take out of context. So I understand why they felt like they had to talk to him, but ultimately I feel like putting his voice, he like really didn't add that much. Like the interview stuff with him was some of the least interesting parts of that documentary. The things that were more interesting to me was talking to the guy who used to work for Jerry Media and talking about, you know, how he got pulled into trying to promote this complete scam. I mean, he didn't know it was a scam at the time. And talking to some of these other kind of talking head figures about this, like how they think it kind of fits into broader trends in millennial culture, some of which kind of felt like a stretch or like they were trying to get too much into the movie. But that was kind of the stuff we didn't get in the Netflix documentary that, you know, sort of is asking the question of like, why do we find this story so interesting?
One of the best parts or more interesting parts of that whole like meta, we joked on the last one that like the documentaries themselves are a fraud about a fraud, right? And I found it interesting. There was in the Netflix one, the guy who was hired as the consultant, like the festival consultant, and kept saying like, this isn't going to work, but stayed on anyway and kept saying it's not going to work. And then he stayed on. That guy said something really interesting at the end. He was talking about how like the whole thing had been built upon both Billy's false reality and his like imparting that on other people, and then the false reality of the show itself. And he was like, I was so aware of that, and it was like four of the worst months of my life, you know, that it was just, it was awful. But then when I looked at my Instagram from those 4 months, everything looked amazing. And like, I just thought that was interesting that like in small and big ways, even someone who knew this was going to be a disaster and kept saying so, like went along with it on social media. And I just thought that was like a really interesting insight, like an even deeper kind of meta to the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think the primary difference aside from aesthetic decisions between the two films is the Netflix movie was a documentary about the Fyre Festival, and the Hulu one was an attempt to be sort of a broader, I don't know if indictment's the right word, but certainly a broader cynical look at just internet culture in general.
But I think that's like a fair thing to do. Like,
yeah, no, I'm not saying either one is wrong. Although, you know, the Hulu one, I think might have been better suited. If that's the case, the Hulu one might have been better suited for a multi-part series. Like, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, that I was watching this Ted Bundy series and the R. Kelly series. And in both cases, I was wondering, you know, how they possibly could have stretched it out over that long. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's more and more to unpack. And one of the issues with the Hulu stuff is they tried to address so many things at once that I think it all just kind of ended up a bit murky at the end.
Yeah, I hear you.
I think that's fair because there's a lot of stuff they touch on that's interesting. So, for example, one of the people they have in the Hulu documentary is Gia Tolentino, who is a writer for The New Yorker. And she did this really interesting piece for The New Yorker about sort of kind of millennial scam culture and why we're fascinated by scammers. And I felt like the article she wrote was interesting. Then to have it reduced to like 30 seconds of a talking head in this movie made it seem really not that interesting and not that revelatory. I think there are a number of things where I was kind of like, oh yeah, that is interesting. And then, you know, but they don't really have time to deal with it. And then on the flip side, I mean, I think, well, one of the things that both of the movies are interested in, but I think the Netflix one is able to get into more deeply, is that idea of when you know something is going wrong, but, you know, I think part of the question, I mean, that it's easy to sort of write off Billy McFarland as basically this pathological liar, you know, piece of shit. But like all these other people who were involved in it, and what both documentaries, but especially the Netflix one, do is they like let a lot of the other people like have a voice and talk about this process of being like, this seems like a disaster. This, you know, I can tell this is going wrong, but like, you know, we feel like we're so committed, or that maybe every event and obviously, you know, that I can imagine some of the TechCrunch events kind of feel like they're kind of out of control until like things, you know, come together at the last minute. And what did not happen in this case is that they sort of tricked them, or what did happen is they tricked themselves into thinking it could come together at the last minute, and instead it just all fell apart. Yeah, I don't know. I that was my favorite thing about it, was like just seeing people talk about, you know, like, because it's easy to just be like, oh, these guys must all be like hustlers and liars, and to actually identify with them a little bit, and like, oh, I like, how would I respond if I were in this situation and had been roped in to try to
Interesting to see the differences. Like, I felt so much more empathy for the guy I was just talking about, the guy who was talking about his Instagram, even though he clearly knew from the beginning, he knew when he got there that this was not going to work. Even though he stayed, I have so much more empathy for him than I do for, like, I don't remember his name. He was the older guy. He had white hair. And he was.
Although he had to tell that one crazy story
because it was crazy of him to do that. Like, that was just a crazy thing. Like, you're a mature dude. Like, you. And he's telling the story about how the only way to get the water for the festival was to suck this guy's dick. And he was ready to go suck this guy's dick. And it's like, for Billy. And I'm just, I can't, I don't have any empathy for that. I like cannot relate to that at all. Like, I cannot relate to caring so much about Billy and Billy's dreams and this stupid fucking festival that I would go do that. And for him to admit that, like, that makes him look like garbage, in my opinion. Like, that's a him thing.
That was definitely, I think, the most like jaw dropping moment in a very jaw dropping. Was that the Netflix one?
Where that's a Netflix.
Told
one.
That story. First of all, listening to the story and the way it resolved itself, I don't know how much of it was made up. I don't know how a lot of it just sounded like they were just kind of ribbing him, but.
His body language actually read like he was a little bit embarrassed to be telling the story. Like, it wasn't like a story he was super pumped to be telling.
I don't know. Aside from how astonishing of a story it is, I think that was also perhaps the most insightful moment from either of the movies in that. So one of the things that the Hulu documentary did better than the Netflix one, because it had Billy on and because it gave us some more background on him, it told us why these people thought he was a genius. Now, once that is revealed, so I watched the Netflix one first. The Netflix one, you kind of are just going along with the fact that, oh yeah, this is like a Silicon Valley guy. People believe him. You know, the three of us have been working in tech for long enough that we basically like know how that goes. The Netflix one or the Hulu one was like, oh yeah, no, this guy thought it took a sheet of metal and made a credit card out of him. And that's why he's a genius. But it's an interesting insight into how far someone will go, how to the ends of the earth they will follow them if they think that this person is a genius. They're willing to forgive so many other things because it's clear that they think this person is a visionary. And like, this is something that we see play out time and time again. We saw it with Theranos, and this is a slightly controversial comment, but you know, I think we see it every time Elon Musk says something
completely crazy. I totally agree with that.
And his followers, our people I know, I won't name any names, but people I know who like write about Tesla, they get really crazy feedback from these people. There have been like death threats. There have been, you know, like doxing threats, all of these completely insane things because somebody is reporting the truth about Elon Musk. And I think it just shows like how much we need a leader and a messiah. And once we believe somebody is a genius, we're willing to go along with them through just about everything. Now, the difference here is like the reasons why these people think this guy is a genius are completely batshit.
Right. Well, and because it's also speaks to this narrative that gets told so often. And I think the most prominent one is the Steve Jobs narrative. And people talk about the idea of the reality distortion field. And when people say that, I think they mean it, you know, a little bit as criticism, but primarily they mean it as like, isn't it crazy that this guy, you know, basically willed these products into existence, even though no one else sort of believed that that the team could do what they did. And I think that's really set this pattern for a lot of other people to be like, yes, I'm a visionary. And so, you know, I'm just going to keep telling you that this is going to happen and eventually it'll happen. And I mean, that seems to obviously have been what Billy McFarland believed. And that's because, you know, again, this is a common narrative that the people who worked for him ended up believing that for a while too. And so there's some, like, I think it, both of them, but particularly the Hulu one, I think highlights how kind of destructive and harmful this narrative has become.
The difference though, or one of the primary differences between a Billy McFarlane and a Steve Jobs or even Elon Musk is yeah, they have these like these big grandiose ideas, but they also surround themselves with incredibly smart people. Like obviously like the engineers that are working at Apple or, you know, SpaceX or Tesla are all incredibly good at their job. Now, Billy McFarlane like surrounds himself with Instagram influencers and media douchebags. I mean, those were like, there were clearly like some smart people behind the scenes, but for the most part, like it seemed like the majority of people he was surrounding himself were like equally full of hot air.
I don't know if I completely agree with that. There's one guy who doesn't get interviewed in either documentary named Grant, who I think was basically the marketing guy for Fire. And he comes off as an even bigger douchebag than Billy. But I think a lot of the other people, whether or not they're, you know, geniuses or at the very top of their field, they seem like people who understand, say, events, or they understand music booking and are really trying their best to make it work. It's just that the whole idea of putting together a festival in this period of time was just fundamentally insane.
Even like a regular festival, like let's say they wanted to do Fire at like Woodstock, like even 4 months would have been like just an outrageous thing to do in that situation where existing infrastructure is in place. But to do it on an island with no infrastructure in 4 months is just an absolutely crazy thing to do. And it makes you think again about like even my favorite guy in the Netflix one. He knows that. He knows you can't do this in 4 months. And he did it anyway, which is dumb. But I have to tell you guys, I'm looking at some tweets about these documentaries. One of them is, the most shocking part of the Fire Festival documentary was when they got into a plane with a man who taught himself to fly on Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Oh yeah, that was so funny.
What? Oh my god!
I just want like so just to back up. So you know, as far as what you said, Anthony. I mean, I think the difference here is there were smart people involved, but those are the people who, I mean, like Billy McFarlane is similar to Donald Trump from the standpoint of there were certain points where he's surrounded by smart people. And if those people don't give him the answer that he wants, those people are fired. There were so many people over the course of both of these documentaries who were telling him like, this is just not going to happen. And those people were like immediately fired. So like, not only is it like completely crazy, but they're bringing people on like 2 days before the festival started to get everything together.
Yeah, and that like there's emails. I think it's some cases it's firing, and some cases it's more that Billy basically says, look, this is an environment for, you know, for positive thinking and for people who have solution. I think it's we're solution oriented, yeah, is the phrase he used. And so if you're not interested in being solution oriented, I don't want to hear
like
it.
Kind of.
And so,
I mean, like, I say this with a huge, huge grain of salt, but like part of me does feel bad for Billy because he's a sociopath clearly and will continue to like hurt people only for himself over and over again, which is bad. And I don't condone that, but also like I don't know, this is like something that I feel like is said a lot about millennials, whether or not I agree with it, and happens a lot in the startup world, which is these people who believe they can do it like against all odds. And you've got to like, that is what it takes to some extent to be an entrepreneur or to be president, right? Like to believe that you can do things that are kind of impossible, but to do it in a healthy, reasonable way, right? And he just like lacked that last piece. And so he just kept putting himself in debt based on his own kind of confidence in himself. And, you know, it's hard to, I get that in a way, but I wouldn't, you know, I obviously never would have taken it as far as he did. And what he did was cruel and awful, and I don't condone it again. But you can see how that can snowball, right? Like that mentality of, oh, our backs are against the wall, but I've got to solve. Like my charm, my wits, like I can do it. I can get us out of this, and just continuing to dig deeper.
There is a moment in one of the two documentaries where, and I, you know, we should probably talk a little bit about Ja Rule later. And I think Ja Rule could have easily have had his own documentary. He doesn't actually appear in either one of these, but where the two of them, I think it's Billy and Ja Rule calls it a moonshot. And that made me like viscerally angry when he said that, because obviously a moonshot is something that gets thrown around a lot in technology. But, you know, the genesis of the term moonshot is for the space race, you know, trying to do something completely crazy that, you know, we were battling the Russians and we landed people on the moon. And it's been co-opted by Silicon Valley culture. And I think in a lot of cases, that's probably okay. But you know, the moonshots are like these crazy world transforming ideas. And he was talking about putting on a festival. I mean, that's, you know, like that was the big thing at the end of the day. This thing that they were selling was
was a music festival, of which there are a lot. And it was just, it was a music festival for rich people. That was the thing. That was the hype cycle. That was the reason why that one guy was going to orally please a stranger, was because of a goddamn music festival.
What's interesting though, and I think this is part of what Jordan was also getting at, was how that behavior does, like, it's crazy when you see it on camera, and it's crazy because of the outcome, but the act of doing that doesn't seem that unusual to me. That I feel like there's a lot of people we deal with at TechCrunch who would do the exact same thing. And in fact, like what that made me think was, recently I was rereading an article of mine that I wrote, where I interviewed this, not when I was at TechCrunch, but at Adweek. And it was about Steve Jobs and this, basically this speech coach, like this very high profile speech coach. And she just like talked about how you can compare the Steve Jobs iPhone launch speech to the I Have a Dream speech that Martin Luther King gave, and you can learn lessons from both. And one of the things, you know, is just when you step back, you're like, that's insane. Like, why would you think that you can compare those two things? That's, you know, like, it's not the same thing to be selling a phone as it is to be, you know, making this, you know, historical speech for racial equality. But like, we have like somehow gotten to this point where people are willing to do that, to say like, well, you know, just the same way like Lincoln did this, I'm going to do that for my like stupid startup idea. Like, and that doesn't,
yeah,
it's, I will, not say that unusual. That any sympathy that I might have harbored for Billy went out the window. And this was covered, I think, at both the documentaries, was after everything went down, you know, after charges were filed, and he was on, I think he was on probation or out on bail at the time. He just kept scamming people, and he scammed the same people that he had scammed before. Like, he's a recidivist. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, he's going to go to jail for what, 6 years, probably not learn his lesson, come out, and then find a new group of people to scam.
I mean, the one thing is, I think he's now basically banned from holding executive roles in companies, right? I forget exactly
Yeah, he's banned from being like a CEO, but like, I mean, and legally he's, I'm sure, banned from scamming people, but you know, didn't stop him before.
But yeah, I mean, that all that stuff about like the second scam, I mean, that was amazing. Just the fact that, I mean, just, it's so ballsy and brazen, just to like that, and that they got multiple people to go on camera talking about that he is, you know, about to go on trial for this shit. And he's still living in this incredibly nice penthouse. that was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, in both cases, I think we were all following along as this was happening online. And again, you know, it was fun to watch it unravel, and it was fun to see what seemed like very unlikable people have a very poor time on the show. But I think they both, one of the ways both of the documentaries was succeeded is, I think they both did a good job of pulling that thread. And there was a lot, even as somebody who was kind of semi following it real time, there was a lot of stuff that I had no idea about.
So you, Brian, you also mentioned you wanted to talk about Ja Rule. What do you think of Ja Rule?
Oh, well, I mean, a lot of this is, this is kind of an ongoing story, you know, cause he's, so there's a moment in, I think the Netflix one, sorry, I watched them a while ago, so I'm kind of conflating them a bit, but were they on speakerphone? Was that in the Netflix one?
Yeah, I think that was the Netflix one where they're on the conference call.
Yeah, they're on the conference call.
Ja Rule's after, like, everything nobody has gone died.
Down. Yeah, exactly. This is after everything went down, and you know, he's like, he's sort of doing the Bill Clinton thing of like parsing things and saying, yeah, it was like false advertising. But he's like, he's very clearly telling them that they need to get out in front of it and that they can still sort of save their asses. And then both of these things drop. And then all of a sudden, you know, Ja Rule is claiming that this is a very Trumpian thing where he's claiming that, like, oh, that he didn't really play a role in any of these things. And, you know, like he didn't take part in decision making. But he does seem like, I understand why he didn't agree to do either of these, because obviously he's like, you know, a prominent musician in his own right. But he does feel like a major missing piece in both the films.
Right. Although I will say that particularly the Netflix documentary, I think that there are both Billy and Ja Rule don't you know, aren't interviewed for the documentary, but you just get a lot of them anyway, because they have all this archival footage from previous trips out to the island, or to the different islands they were considering, when they were trying to figure out a location, and a lot of behind the scenes footage from when they're planning, trying to put the festival together. So I feel like you get, they both have a real presence in the documentaries, even though they're not interviewed. So in that sense, I didn't necessarily mind that and in fact, because when they actually got, you know, Billy on camera for an interview, I find that so unsatisfying. I'm not really convinced that would have added that much to either of the films.
Well, I mean, it was interesting at the beginning of one of the two, where there were a lot of moments where they were showing them sort of like on stage at events that, you know, that looked a lot like Disrupt.
Less good Disrupt.
Yeah. But like, I mean, in both cases, there were things that I think really did kind of hit close to home in terms of what we do as reporters, as people who cover all these companies, as people who, like, to some degree, depending on companies and products, like, do play a bit of the role in the hype cycle, you know, who are covering companies like Theranos early on. So that was, I don't know, that was kind of interesting to watch it play out in that way. In the same way that I think it'll be interesting to, again, watch like the Theranos documentary, to just like, as just sort of a check on ourselves and what we do as the media. But, you know, I would have liked more insight into what Ja Rule did from the standpoint of, it's not clear how much of it was him just putting his name on it, which is something like celebrities do all the time, which, you know, we have a lot of non-tech celebrities at Disrupt who are getting really into VC. You know, we've got a lot of like sports figures and actors, musicians and things like that. And they all play a varying role in the end product. And here, I think it wasn't sort of entirely clear how much of it was him just saying, yeah, this guy seems like a genius. Yeah, I'll slap my name on it, and how much he like really sort of propelled it forward. I do think that the speakerphone moment was some interesting insight into the role he played in trying to screw a lot of people over.
Yeah. Did you guys notice that in the Hulu documentary, in fact, when they're talking about the startup that Billy did before Magnesis, I forget what it was called, but they actually had a screenshot of a TechCrunch article that was written about his previous startup.
Yeah, I saw that. Glad you chose to bring it up.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to like make this all about TechCrunch or anything like that, but I do think like that certainly that I had a similar experience to Brian, that I think like there's certain that, I mean, a lot of this is nothing, you know, is much larger than any of us and doesn't have anything to do with TechCrunch, but like in as much as like that kind of what I think people like talk about in shorthand is like Silicon Valley culture. Like, I think that it is fair to say that some of the gross things about FIRE come from that culture of sort of, you know, fake it till you make it, which is not just from Silicon Valley culture, but that's certainly something that has been celebrated in Silicon Valley. And so I certainly like makes me, and I think a lot of things have, but certainly watching these two documentaries have made me a lot more wary of that kind of personality, more wary about writing anything that like celebrates that kind of personality.
I think Billy, I mean, Billy, regardless, would have been a good used car salesman. He's a good salesman. You know, he could have been run like a hedge fund or something like that. But there are certain aspects of Silicon Valley culture that enabled him to get to the heights that he did, regardless of what he was actually selling at any given time.
Is there anything else about the documentaries or what we learned or anything like that we want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about the sort of the lead up. I don't know how much insight, Anthony, you have into this. I think you've done more reading on this than I have. But as far as how these two films came out, like right next to each other, and maybe to some degree it was a sort of like Armageddon Deep Impact situation. It was a very big story. Clearly a lot of people were going after it. Everybody who watched it unfold in real time knew that it would ultimately make a good documentary. But you know, the Netflix one was announced for a while. And part of it was because, again, it was just like very, very prominent documentary director. So people were eagerly waiting. And while they were, Netflix or Hulu just sort of dropped theirs overnight. It just kind of appeared on Netflix. They announced it. It was there. And clearly they knew the Netflix thing was happening because, again, the parting shot in the film was a comment on the competitor.
Right. So I don't know. I mean, if I were to guess, I would guess that, you know, that they sort of began production sort of independently, which happens, I think, a fair amount in movie making. But that, yeah, it seems like Hulu's release strategy was designed around the Netflix release, and that they knew that if they put it out right before, they could sort of take advantage of some of the discussion and then also create this whole kind of one versus the other thing. And I don't think it's like the worst thing in the world, but it does seem like in some ways it sort of then just turns it into this kind of one versus the other narrative, which, I mean, I guess that's something we've done a little bit on this, you know, show too. And I think that's fair because they're two movies about the same thing, but in some ways it feels like, I don't know, a little, it just seems like more drama on top of something that was already so dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair. And Hulu certainly knew that, like, most people aren't weirdos like us. Most people aren't going to watch both of them. Most people are going to assume that, like, they're going to have a passing interest in this thing. Maybe they'll have recognized that, you know, remembered it from a while ago on Instagram or whatever, and will want to watch one documentary. So, you know, based on the hype cycle, they're going to watch probably the one that came out first. Maybe a good way to end this segment is to have everybody, you know, if someone is only going to watch one or the other, which it probably applies to a vast majority of people, which one should they watch?
I can go first. And I mean, it's the Netflix one, I think, is much better. It tells you get like a full story, and it's much more focused versus, I think, the Hulu one, which I appreciated, is just kind of trying to like take in all these different things and is kind of all over the place. So if you're going to watch one, watch Netflix. But if you have the time to watch both, watch both.
I agree with that. And I think if you're going to watch both, watch Netflix first. I watched Hulu first, and I think that's not the right combo.
Yeah, I think it's unanimous.
Netflix tells the core story, I think, and Hulu is then it's like, if you want to start thinking about like the bigger thoughts, that's what the Hulu documentary does a little bit more of.
Netflix focuses more on the festival specifically, and it's just like beginning to end, just a much better put together documentary.
Cool. Just as a reminder to all of our listeners, if you enjoy listening to this podcast, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also subscribe on any other podcast app that you enjoy. Brian also has a podcast of his own. Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
You can also find it on Spotify and iTunes and Google Play. We're on YouTube now. Are you guys on YouTube yet?
We're not on YouTube yet. No.
Apparently,
we'll get
apparently
there.
People listen to podcasts on YouTube. We had John Glazer on recently. John Roderick, the lead singer of the Spin Doctors, was on the show. Michael McDonald. It's a Marissa Nadler. A lot of a wide-ranging collection of interviews, including, you know, musicians, artists, creative types. Oh, fans of TechCrunch will probably enjoy the Douglas Rushkoff interview that's going to go up in about a week or two, where we talk about the state of the internet and how it's ruining our lives.
Right. So that is the RIYL podcast, or is it? Wait, RIYL. Yes. RIYL cast.
It's RIYL. You can find that at RIYLcast.tumblr.com.
Sounds good. All right. So go check it out. Jordan and Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.